Hello, this is The Money, RN's economics show. I'm Richard Adey. Are you sitting comfortably? It's story time.
Out in the woods in a house of pink live three bears. And what do you think?
Papa Bear was a great big bear.
Mama Bear was a middle-sized bear.
Baby Bear was a little baby bear. And they lived in a house of pink, pink, pink.
To be absolutely honest with you, I did not know about the pink thing, but I also completely accept that Play School's better informed than me on this issue. So, the three bears. We're starting with them because today is all about economic growth and a particular question. Is there a Goldilocks number for it? One that's not too hot or too cold, but just right? As usual, we have help.
My name's Richard Holden and I'm a Professor of Economics at UNSW Australia Business School.
Richard, what is economic growth?
Economic growth is the change in the total amount of stuff, if you like, that an economy produces in a year. So when you hear a number like the economy grew at 3% last year, means cumulatively, taking everything together, the total amount of goods and services increased by 3% on the year before.
Sounds simple, but there's more to it than that. Let's hear from the next expert.
Oh, now?
Yep.
Amy Oster, Executive Director at the Australian Centre for Financial Studies.
What drives economic growth?
The driver that we like to see for economic growth is what we call productivity growth. And that means that the factors of productivity, so labour and capital, are being used in an efficient way and an effective way. And we get productivity growth a couple of different ways. One can be through population growth. Another can be through technical innovation or adaptation. Those are sort of two of the very good drivers of productivity growth. Then there's other forms of growth, like you can generate a consumption boom, for example, by increasing the borrowing in the economy, by increasing the leverage in the economy. That's generally viewed as a less healthy way to generate economic growth.
So productivity growth is what economists would like to see driving economic growth in Australia. But is it?
It's a funny thing to think about because for much of the early part of this century, Australia had very low, very, very low to zero, actually, productivity growth. It didn't feel like that because we had the mining boom, we had very high terms of trade, so we had very high growth in income, but our productivity growth was actually very low. My perception is, and we need to see the data coming through, but my perception is that now that the mining boom is falling away, a number of other things are coming into place that will allow productivity growth to start to resume. So when the government talks about, you know, the ideas boom and a focus on innovation, that's very important for productivity. And factors such as the lower Australian dollar should help encourage firms to invest in Australia, and that can also help to boost productivity growth.
So why do we need to boost productivity and drive economic growth? Well, the most basic reason is that our population is growing.
I guess it's a bit of a catch-22, isn't it? So generally speaking, the population does continue to grow. And so at the basic level, you need to have enough food, enough shelter, enough services to meet the needs of your population. And population does continue to expand. In some countries faster than in others, and in Australia, our population growth rate is quite stable. But if you don't grow your economy and you have more and more people, then, you know, on average, people will feel that they're worse off. If you don't have any population growth, so for example, Japan, you know, then you tend to actually have not a lot of economic growth, or you may even contract. And, you know, generally speaking, that's something that tends to worry people. You can go along like that for some time, but it becomes difficult for the economy to, gain traction after a period of very low or negative growth.
That's not an issue we have to deal with here. For some time now, the Australian economy has grown at about 3% a year. But what if we don't? What are the consequences for low growth?
History has taught us that when you have economies that don't grow, that are stagnant, where people don't feel that their standard of living and quality of life is getting better off, there's much more of a focus on grabbing resources from other people. And when the economic pie is growing and things are getting better, if you like, the sort of old aphorism of rising tide lifting all boats, politics works a lot better and there's much less attention focused on grabbing resources from other people rather than creating new resources.
So are there genuine issues that arise if we grow at less than 3%?
Well, there are these distributional concerns making it harder to help the least well-off in society, that the politics of that just becomes harder. The other thing that we're facing in Australia and many advanced economies are facing is an ageing population. So a lot of the debate that we see at the moment is around these programs that are very important, social programs like the age pension, like Medicare and so on. The rate of expenditure of those programs is growing at between 6 and 7% per annum, and that's the thing that's putting a lot of pressure on the federal budget. These make up the lion's share of the federal budget, and they're growing at 6 to 7% per annum. So if we don't grow national income at a rate relatively close to that, then we'll have to cut back on those programs or something we'll have to give, and that's a very serious concern, particularly as we have more people out of the workforce and living longer, which is obviously a good thing, but more people retired and fewer people working per person that, if you like, is getting taken care of.
And once you take the focus off Australia and think on the global scale, the argument becomes more compelling.
It's very important for lifting people out of poverty. So this is slightly less of an issue in Australia, but if you look around the world, we know that about 1 in 8 people in the world live on less than $1.90 a day. And you can look at different levels beyond that and, you know, very low levels with people more than a quarter of the world living on less than $3 a day and so on and so on. These people are living in extreme poverty and economic growth has the potential to lift them out of that poverty. So, for example, since 1981, that number has reduced by 1 billion people around the world. And the great bulk of that has come from people moving out of extreme poverty in China. And, of course, we all know that China, in the last 25 years, embarked on an economic modernization program, which led their economy to grow at between 7 and 10% per year, year on year. And that's lifted, most estimates say, about 800 to 850 million people out of extreme poverty.
That seems hard to argue with, but not everybody buys the idea of economic growth as a force for good.
My name is Samuel Alexander. I'm a research fellow with the Melbourne Sustainable Society Institute.
Samuel is a proponent of an idea that seems to be growing more prominent, zero or post-growth economies. And the reasoning is simple. We can't grow forever when we live on a finite planet.
If the rich nations keep growing by 2% over the next few decades, and by 2050 the poorest have caught up to us more or less, which seems to be the implicit or explicit global development agenda, the global economy would be 15 times larger than it is today. If it continued growing at 3% by the end of the century, the global economy would be 60 times bigger than it is today. Now, given that we are already in ecological overshoot, can you imagine what a global economy 60 times bigger than it is today would do to our ecosystems? It would produce ecosystemic collapse, no question.
But as you heard a minute or so ago, despite the success that economic growth's had in alleviating poverty, there's still a huge number of people who are struggling to survive.
The argument that I offer in response to the poverty question, how can we resolve poverty if not through growth, the main response is through redistribution. This isn't to say that parts of the world shouldn't still grow in some form, develop their economic capacities in order to provide for basic material needs. But the key aspect which the neoliberal world order doesn't like talking about is redistribution. It's a very unpopular method of poverty alleviation in the world as we know it today.
Samuel Alexander raises something fundamental. For most of the history of economic growth, it's been driven by population increase and the ability to extract and use energy and resources. But Amy Oster says there's actually been several factors.
And the biggest one has been technological innovation. In fact, I was listening to somebody give a talk on this not so long ago to say that, you know, only sort of 300 years ago, the percentage of the human population that ever ventured outside a 20-kilometer radius from where they were born was very, very small because transport costs were so high. Now, that's not oil-related. That's simply the infrastructure of roads didn't exist, and the technology of transport was very poor compared to what we have today. We can think of the innovation of, you know, the telephone and being able to communicate across long distances very easily, and the growth that that brought about. And then you carry on to the internet and everything that that's done for growth. So it's not necessarily the case that growth is inherently linked to the amount of resources that we have available. And I think one of the exciting opportunities for the future is to think about growth with a more efficient use of resources through renewable resources. That's an innovation that's coming along every day.
We are getting more efficient in the use of our energy and the use of our resources, but there is this strange rebound effect that occurs. What happens when we produce things more efficiently is they tend to get cheaper. That means that it incentivizes increased consumption, and it also opens up markets so that more people can afford these commodities. So, for example, if we were able to make our cars with 80% less steel and ran on 50% less fuel, these types of dematerialization strategies, that would make cars more affordable for all 7 or 8 billion people. Mm. Now, if all 8 billion people then drove cars, despite those efficiency gains, the overall energy and resource consumption would go up.
Samuel Alexander. I'm Richard Ady, and this is The Money, RN's show about economics. Today you're hearing about economic growth. We began with the question of whether there's a Goldilocks number, an amount that's just right. But right now we're in the middle of another question. Is economic growth itself unsustainable? Sam says yes, and the alternative he proposes, not having economic growth, is gaining a bit more prominence. But I wonder if it doesn't have a flaw, that it doesn't fit with human nature.
There is nothing against our interests in pursuing a post-growth model. And I would explain that by saying there is great scope for rethinking our conceptions of what the good life looks like. And I think there is great scope for reducing our material and energy demands and at the same time increasing our quality of life. To give one sort of simple but illuminating example, if people were to reduce their working hours by 10 hours per week, this may require reduced consumption. This would lead to less income, but there is a very plausible case to be made that quality of life could increase. Now, that's a microeconomic example of a transition that could occur at the macroeconomic level. So in order to respond to the human nature argument, which is essentially people aren't going to do something that isn't in their interests, the response I would give that it is in our interests, both short-term and long-term. In the short-term interests, we could essentially be exchanging superfluous consumption for more free time. And in the long-term version, if we keep pursuing the existing growth model, we are going to grow ourselves into a catastrophe which isn't in our interests either.
But there's no question that most of us want stuff and want experiences. We do. And part of that, surely, is about status.
That's probably part of the challenge that we face. We are bombarded thousands of times every day with advertisements and more subtle cultural messages which tell us that the good life consists in luxury and high consumption lifestyles and celebrity and all of this kind of thing. And in that cultural context, it's very understandable why we think that the good life consists in all of those types of things. And so it kind of points to the complexity of our challenge. Like, there is a biophysical reality, which we've talked about, that says we simply cannot pursue this, but it also requires almost a cultural evolution so that people acquire status in different ways. And I think that's possible, but it will require a huge amount of cultural challenge and resistance and people exploring different forms of the good life so that people are exposed to different conceptions of the good life.
Samuel Alexander. Let's go back to the question of whether economic growth can be what the economists call decoupled from exhausting our resources and damaging the environment. Richard Holden.
We can't completely decouple it, but I think that there is a very important link between technical change and the use of finite resources. So there's every now and then you'll read some kind of claim that says, well, the amount of resources on the planet are finite, so we can't keep growing at a very large rate. In fact, when I write opinion pieces in various newspaper outlets and so on, you can guarantee that about one in five of the comments says, you know, you're just an idiot economist who thinks that we can grow forever and we can't because there's only a finite amount of oil in the world and, you know, shame on you. Now, there is a finite amount of oil in the world, but take the example of energy. So we've seen that as it gets harder to extract stuff, so we've definitely got better at digging stuff out of the ground, but as the stuff in the ground gets deeper and harder to get to, that makes it trickier and more expensive to get to. So what's been the reaction to that, say, in the last 5 or 10 years in terms of energy? We've seen the cost of wind power, for instance, has fallen about 30% over the last 5 years. The cost of solar panels has been falling at an almost exponential rate, suggesting almost the same kind of, not quite as fast, but the same kind of trend that we saw with semiconductors and so-called Moore's Law about putting every year putting twice the number of semiconductors on an integrated circuit board. And so economics itself helps us drive new ways to find growth as the price of old resources becomes more expensive because they get more scarce. It gives incentives for people to find new ways to provide resources, and energy is a good example of that.
Amy Auster agrees about energy, but says we need to make progress in other areas.
Food is something that's probably a bit trickier because you need a certain amount of arable land and you certainly need an amount of water in order to produce enough food to feed the planet. And so I think when we look at a global population that surpasses 7 billion and goes towards 9 billion and we think about the challenge of sustainably feeding 9 billion people, I don't know that we have the answer to that one yet. That's probably our big challenge.
Perhaps we can do better. Perhaps we can do it all. Toward the end of last year, the CSIRO released the Australian National Outlook. It modelled the Australian economy through to 2050. It assumed the population would keep growing and that climate change would have an impact. And it turns out that as long as we try to mitigate greenhouse gases and use water and resources more efficiently, we can have our cake and eat it too. Steve Hatfield-Dodds is the economist who led the project.
We find that when the world takes stronger action than it is now, and you could argue that Paris itself indicates that the world is proposing to do more than it has been, and when people do start using water and energy more efficiently, both those help substantially to position you for a world where economic growth continues to be strong, but resource use falls, water stress in our river systems is stable or falls, and greenhouse gas emissions certainly fall a lot, and one of the things we look at is the potential to use land sector market, so people paying farmers to sequester carbon in trees and so on, and you can harness those markets to also improve conservation outcomes. And so that that gets you a situation where the economy is growing and you're restoring native habitat and protecting biodiversity better than we are now. So
just to be clear, Steve, there are actually scenarios that you've come up with that you think are plausible using the assumptions that are they're based on existing trends in which we can have our cake and eat it too.
Yes, absolutely. And the real trick here is that we haven't really tried to do this before. So we find essentially that it's not very hard. These scenarios are quite plausible and in the range of experience here in Australia and overseas. And you can get strong economic growth and reduce environmental pressure. Now, we study four or more different environmental pressures, and different combinations give you slightly different patterns. So we don't find many scenarios where every environmental indicator gets better, but we find at least three amongst the 18 or 20 that we model in detail where none of those indicators get worse and some of them get a lot better.
This sounds all very well, but how much economic growth are we talking about?
So in our assumptions, economic growth doesn't vary very much across sustainable and less sustainable scenarios. So we model in real terms without inflation, and we get 2.4 to 2.6% growth. So that's the equivalent of 4 to 5% economic growth. It's quite solid and respectable once you add inflation back in. But most of the variation, that 2.4 to 2.6, most of that is about assumptions to do with working hours. They have nothing to do with environmental performance or policies.
Steve, it sounds too good to be true. Is there going to be some kind of hair shirt element to this where we have a horrible time but we get this great scenario? I'm just wondering, do we have to fight human nature to get to this?
No, we look specifically, we go back and look at our scenarios and say which of these are to do with bottom-up choices and which to do are to do with policies. And there are a range of bottom-up choices that businesses and households can make, especially about efficiency. If you save water, you also save water bills. If you save energy, you save energy bills. And so that plays out well. But we don't have any big changes in human nature in our model. So you could model that, but our scenarios don't include that, and you get this substantial decoupling. So really what you're seeing is that when people's circumstances change, their strategies to achieve what they want to achieve change a little bit as well. And so you don't need a big change in energy prices or the rules around the water use for plantings, for example. You don't need big changes in these things to get quite substantial changes in outcomes over the long term. So remember, we're looking forward out to 2050. So there's a 35-year path to make that adjustment. And part of what's happening here is the world is uncertain. People are adjusting to things all the time. And so in a sense, it would be strange not to adjust in this way.
The key assumption, of course, is that the world takes stronger action on climate change. But if that's what happens, Australia is uniquely well placed to prosper.
The conventional finding in this sort of area, when you look at climate change in particular, is that if you reduce emissions now, that requires some more upfront investment. And so the amount of income you have left to consume is lower in the short term. We find that Australia actually has a comparative advantage in things to do with the landscape. We've got a lot of land and we can use it in smarter ways. And so in a world that is taking stronger action on climate change, we find the table shift in favour of avoiding emissions, sequestering carbon in trees, and those activities are actually more profitable than some fossil fuel intensive activities like digging up coal and exporting it. So we find that Australia has stronger economic growth and is richer by 2050 if the world and Australia take stronger action on climate change.
The key message of the National Outlook, and it's worth reading, you'll find a link on the Money's homepage, is that we can do this, grow the economy without trashing the environment, if we choose to. It won't just happen.
Goldilocks went into the dining room, where she saw the three bowls of porridge.
She tasted the big bowl, but it was too cold.
She tasted the middle bowl, but it was too hot.
She tasted the little bowl and it was just right, and so she ate it all up.
So we're back to the question, what's the just right number for economic growth? Well, it depends who you ask.
For Australia, we generally say that trend growth is around 3% for real GDP, so that's inflation adjusted GDP. And I think that's about right, you know, assuming kind of a steady level of population growth. That seems to be the pace of economic growth that provides for sufficient employment without generating excess inflation. So that seems to be the right number for Australia, and it has been now for quite some time. So this is a mature economy. We don't expect that that's going to change dramatically. Other countries that are not in the position of being a mature economy, that are a developing economy, where the population has a lower income level, would want to see a higher rate of growth.
Well, you have to define what you're trying to achieve to get down to a number. But if you wanted to, say, double living standards every generation, and I'll take 25 years as being a generation, if you wanted to do that, you may not want to, but if you wanted to do that, you would need per capita growth of 3% per annum. So when you see GDP numbers reported, the most recent number that came out for 2015 was the economy grew at 3%. That's total, that's not per capita or per person. If you had a number closer to 4%, that would lead to a doubling of per person standard of living every generation.
If it's 4%, how do we get there?
One of the things that economic theory and the evidence that has come to support it has taught us over the last 20 years or so is that a really important factor in economic growth is human capital and technological change. So the sort of old school view, and it was captured in the so-called neoclassical growth model that was developed by an American Nobel laureate, Robert Solow, and an Australian economist, Trevor Swan, at the Australian National University at the same time. And that emphasized the role of physical capital, plant, equipment, and things like that in driving economic growth. We've come to understand in the last two decades or so that human capital and technological change are incredibly important. So policies that spur growth in human capital and technological change are a really important way to try and drive growth higher. And that's something that policy at the federal and state level can definitely address.
That sounds like investing in education to me.
Well, absolutely. So investing in education is a key driver of human capital, and investing in the right sort of education for a changing economy. So that's incredibly important. And there's very good evidence around the world that countries that invest in education well do grow faster. So that's an incredibly important thing. How you do that is a whole nother question, and it's easier said than done. Simply throwing money at the problem isn't necessarily the answer, but it certainly does require investment and resources being directed towards it.
Actually, both Richard Holden and Amy Oster are optimistic about the challenge of growing the economy and finding ways to do that sustainably.
I think humans are incredibly innovative and creative and have solved the problems that have come along so far. You know, I grew up in Chicago, and Chicago has this fantastic Lake Michigan sitting right there. When I was a kid, you couldn't swim in Lake Michigan because of all the factories that were operated at the bottom of the lake in Gary, Indiana. And when I was a kid, we certainly had no idea that only 10 or 15 years down the track that there would be a huge environmental cleanup and that the lake would be beautiful again. But that's exactly what happened. So, you know, I think challenges come along and people work together to figure out a way to solve them.
I am optimistic, particularly in Australia, and I think for two reasons. I think, one, we've seen an enormous array of technical progress around the world that's helping us make better use of limited resources and, in fact, finding new resources to use. We simply couldn't use wind or the sun to create energy some years ago, and now we can. In fact, in that example, almost all the new electricity generation in advanced economies in the last 10 years has come from renewable resources. So we're doing that, and there are just powerful technical and efficiency reasons why that happens. I think the second reason is that Australia has, we might not think it sometimes, but a fairly functional political system. We're not nearly as polarized as a country like the US. We actually agree on, we have our differences, but we actually agree on a great deal of stuff. And if you look at the two major political parties, they both have policies that are fairly pro-growth and also acknowledge the need for redistribution. So I'm quite optimistic, at least in the Australian case.
Richard Holden is Professor of Economics at the University of New South Wales Australia Business School. You also heard from Amy Oster, the Executive Director of the Australian Centre for Financial Studies, Samuel Alexander, Research Fellow at the Melbourne Sustainable Society Institute, and Steve Hatfield-Dodds, who led the Australian National Outlook Project at the CSIRO. Thanks to all of them. You can find out more about all of this on our homepage. Just go to abc.net.au/rn. You'll see the money. The program is produced by Kate Piercy and Melanie Christensen. Our sound engineer is Anne-Marie de Bettencourt. I'm Richard Ady.
Don't stop me, 'cause I'm having a good time, having a good time.
I'm a shooting star, leaping through the